Welcome back to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone, and we are talking about the art of melody. And in this episode, we are exploring the power of a single musical line in music history. An organization of pitches and tones in a certain order that we know as the tune or the theme or the subject of a piece of music. The melody, as we call it. So next on this program, we'll get into our segment, Sounds of Scripture, where we survey the Bible's many references to music, and these references give us insight into what ancient music was like. That interesting musical example we just heard was the work of a French musicologist by the name of Suzanne Eichventura. In the 1970s, she did extensive research into the music of the Hebrew Bible. That's a recording of her realizing what Psalm 150 might have sounded like. The music of the Hebrew Bible, she said, was contained in the accents written above and below the Hebrew text, what the Jews call the Teamim, or what are simply referred to as cantillation marks. These marks appear in the most authoritative and ancient of Hebrew scripture. It seems Jesus himself referred to them in the New Testament when he talked about the jot and tittle of the law, the jot, of course, or the iota, being the smallest Hebrew letter, but the tittle referring to those accents above and below the letters, which was him saying that his ministry would not even contradict those marks of the Hebrew Bible, much less any larger letters or phrases. Eichventura felt that if she could decode these musical notations, she could give us an idea of what the Bible's music sounded like. Now, to whatever degree of accuracy she achieved, her work did some important things for the study of ancient music and the study of biblical music. They presented, as we're talking about on this show today, a possible melody for the Hebrew scriptures. Now, whether or not this melody was written at the same time as the text, or whether it was added later by the one canonizing the text, say Ezra, for example, putting a melody in as a mnemonic, one thing this does present us with is the presence, anciently, of a diatonic scale or a seven-note scale in the ancient Hebrew culture. Even if these canonized marks do not give us any more than the melody, we do see potential melody in these marks. And we are talking about melody today, and melody is an organization of pitches or tones or frequencies, and there is historic and biblical evidence that the building blocks of these ancient biblical melodies were based on the same kinds of scales that we have today in Western music. First, there's an interesting Hebrew word called shemanit, and that means eighths. Now, this word finds itself in the inscription of two psalms, Psalm 6 and Psalm 12. It also finds itself in a reference to when King David transferred the Ark of the Covenant to Jerusalem, where some of the orchestra members were commanded to play upon shemanit, or upon the eighth, or in eighths. Now, many scholars agree that this is referring to one of the most commonly used musical intervals, the octave. The octave is a musical term for the interval of an eighth, referring to the distance between two pitches. So let's say, on a modern piano, I play the white key just to the left of the grouping of two black keys. That's a C. Now, you find the next grouping of two black notes and play the note to the left of those two, and you'll notice it sounds a lot like the first note you played. In fact, it's also called a C. Though they're two different notes, one sounds higher, one sounds lower, they have the same name. They're both C. They are an octave apart. The interesting part of the word shemanit is that the Hebrews called this musical interval an eighth. Now that shows something about their scale system, I believe. The first note and the eighth note were that perfect interval so common in music, the octave. And that implies seven intervening notes between those two frequencies. Now looking at the use of that word in 1 Chronicles 15, the processional for the Ark of the Covenant, it says some musicians were to play their harps in this manner, or upon shemanit, or in octaves, or on the eighth, literally, in order to excel, and that phrase meant to oversee or to lead. So the Hebrew text here is likely implying that these men played their harps or sang the melody an octave higher, or possibly lower, basically in octaves, a technique that would have made their pitches stand out in the texture. Their eighth would be the lead part of the composition. And that's a common composition technique today, where a composer will add power to a melody by having a group of musicians, or even just one musician, play it an octave higher, double it an octave higher, or double the bass line an octave lower, as the double basses do. Now, this heptatonic scale, or this seven-tone scale, is implied as being a part of ancient Hebrew music. Credible music sources like the New Oxford History of Music confirm the antiquity of this seven-note scale, saying that one cannot call the pentatonic scale, for instance, the five-note scale, older than the heptatonic scale. We might just assume that the pentatonic scale would have come first. Richard Wallacek wrote a book in 1893 called Primitive Music, and in it he writes, "A succession of tones exactly corresponding to our diatonic scale, or part of it, occurs in instruments in the Stone Age, and that we have no reason to conclude that a period of pentatonic scales necessarily preceded the period of heptatonic ones." Now, some may argue that the ancient Chinese used the pentatonic scale. We tend to associate Chinese music with pentatonic music. But Francis Galpin showed in 1937 that a famous Chinese antiquary of the imperial house, Prince Caiyu, who lived in the 16th century, showed by quotations from ancient Chinese authors that from the most distant days of antiquity, their scale had seven recognized sounds. The original present official five-note scale for the popular instruments that still possess seven tones, is due to an edict, he writes, due to an edict in the Ming Dynasty, 15th century AD. So it's not that the pentatonic scale preceded the heptatonic scale. The seven-note scale goes way back. In Ike Von Tura's book, Music of the Bible Revealed, she shows how in 1968, Babylonian cuneiform was discovered that unequivocally attested to the total similarity between the Babylonian scale and our own C major scale. And they witnessed to a system graphically confirmed, she writes, based upon diatonic modes of 7 degrees. James L. Mercel, in his remarkable 1946 article on Psychology and the Problem of the Scale, showed how the human mind interprets aural cues much like it does visual cues. He said, you know, you can look at the Parthenon and see a rectangle, though not a single right angle actually exists. The same applies to musical sounds, he says, that the mind puts music into an order system. He writes, "Without this organizing, ordering, cosmos-building function of the human mind, all perception would be impossible, and of course the art of music would be impossible too." One of Pythagoras's contributions to music theory was the discovery of ratios between the intervals of pitch. The relationship between the pitches in the diatonic scale, as Mercel showed, are simple whole number ratios. The intervals of the heptatonic scales yield ratios that can be expressed as multiples of the lower prime numbers 1, 2, 3, 5, and 7. On the other hand, Mercel explains that all other scale systems yield ratios that are quite complex. The Siamese scale that divides the octave into 7 equal steps, ours divides it into a series of whole steps and half steps. That scale that divides it into seven equal steps, and the Javanese pentatonic scale that divides the octave into five equal steps, they yield intervals that are, he says, vague, non-insistent, and musically non-functional. They are like cloud shapes or ink blots, not like triangles or rectangles or circles to which our intervals may be compared. So he's using a visual metaphor there, saying the soundness of our scale, the seven-note scale, the scale that can be found even in antiquity, in Chinese antiquity, Babylonian antiquity, and Hebrew antiquity, that yields the musical equivalent of triangles, rectangles, circles, where these other scale systems, the Siamese, the Javanese, that aren't based on those whole steps and half steps, they yield complex and musically non-functional cloud shapes and ink blots, as opposed to these concrete shapes. Thus, they exhibit a tonal logic and so an aesthetic expressiveness far more meager than our own. So there is something quite sound about the seven-tone scale, the heptatonic scale, the series of whole steps and half steps that are based upon an overtone series. That's a whole other scientific phenomenon in music we can save for another day. Ike von Tura states that the diatonic modes, the seven-note scale modes, are capable of expressing everything, the quintessence of feelings or banality or insipidness. They reflect what is breathed into them. They basically are the ingredients for any type of music. And she quotes François-Auguste Gavert, who saw in the scale the manifestation of a general law, a consequence of the physiological organization of man. Mercel said it could be argued with much force that our scale is the best that has ever appeared, perhaps the best that can ever be devised. If so, it is best in the specific sense of providing the greatest possible wealth of simple, intelligible tonal forms, he writes. Now, neuroscientist Daniel J. Levitin wrote a book called This Is Your Brain on Music. And in it, he discusses experiments that have shown that young children, as well as adults, are better able to learn and memorize melodies that are drawn from scales that contain unequal distances, such as this, such as the seven-tone scale, based on the system of whole steps and half steps, not dividing the octave into seven equal parts, because that actually contradicts the overtone series, as I mentioned a moment ago. But unequal distances, that seven-tone scale equips us to better understand and learn and memorize melodies, according to the research that Levitin brings out. Now, going back to Ike von Tura and those teamim, or those cantillation marks, or those accents found above and below the original Hebrew text, she found among the lower signs, the ones that she said are the basic pitches, the upper signs were more ornamental, those lower signs, she found essentially seven unique symbols. In some of the books, there are eight symbols, but the first and the eighth are almost identical, with the eighth having just a tiny slash of a difference. She asserted that the symbol indicated by a vertical straight line denoted tonic, or the tonal center of the piece. Ike von Tura's decoding aside, music based on a diatonic scale actually favors one pitch over the rest, a pitch where the music feels final. This is something built into the scale. And so we would understand that this type of music would have a tonal center. It would have a place where the music would want to gravitate to. Levitin writes this: entirely without our conscious awareness, our brains are keeping track of how many times particular notes are sounded, where they appear in terms of strong versus weak beats, and how long they last. A computational process in the brain makes an inference about the key we're in based on these properties. You listen to a piece of music, and you know what the last note's probably going to be. You hear the piece, and you hear it going toward this final note, and if someone sang the end of Row, Row, Row Your Boat, merrily, 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 life is but a, you would know where to sing the word dream, because your brain is keeping track of those things. He says, in spite of our lack of formal musical education, we know what the composer intended to establish as the tonal center or key of the piece, and we recognize it when he brings us back home to the tonic or when he fails to do so, what we call a deceptive cadence, perhaps. So the seven-tone scale has these built-in tendencies leading to a strong note, much like a gravitational pull toward a pitch. Mercel proved this by discussing the ratios created by the pitch relationships in the heptatonic scale. The built-in tensions and relaxations of those pitch relationships make available, he said, an immense range of expectancies for the composer to manipulate and yield a highly expressive music. The effects of tension and relaxation, leading tones and resolution, they're not products of convention and familiarity. He says, the tendential and relational effects of any musical system are not due to convention, use, or want, but are the logical implications of the scale that determines its patterns. So harmonic tension, relaxation, progression, and tonality are all part of the seven-note, seven-tone heptatonic scale and therefore would have been in the music of ancient Israel. That scale would have been the group of ingredients from which they would have gotten their melodies. And to this day, we teach this fundamental ordering of pitches known as the scale in music education. And this leads us to our next segment, Classroom Corner, where we explore different methods and curricula for introducing young people to music.
Yo! A deer, a female deer.
Ray!
A drop of golden sun.
Me!
A name I call myself.
Bah!
A long, long way to run.
So, a needle pulling thread.
La! A note to follow, so.
That's a famous moment in the musical The Sound of Music, performed there by Julie Andrews, where her character was teaching music to children. And what she's doing is introducing these children to the basic building blocks of melody, that is, that seven-note scale we talked about in our last segment. And the device she is employing is called solfège, which gives seven distinct syllables or names to the seven pitches of the scale. Now, in that Rodgers and Hammerstein song, the character is giving a mnemonic for how to remember those seven names. Do sounds like the name of a female deer. Re sounds like light that comes from the sun. Mi is another name for yourself. Fa sounds like far in British, and so on. Now, these seven names have been used in music education for so many years now, and what they do is introduce young people to the degrees of the scale. If you took a musical instrument, you know that we name pitches by the letters of the alphabet, A, B, C, D, E, F, G. But this device called solfège names the pitches differently. It teaches the relationships between each note in a scale. And by assigning syllables to specific degrees of the scale, you can better recognize certain musical intervals. You learn that the space between mi and fa, for example, or ti and do, are called a half step. They sound closer together than do and re, for instance, which are a whole step apart. It also teaches that the tonic note, or the home note, where everything goes back to, as Julie Andrews sang, is do. Everything gravitates back to do, so it teaches even the tendencies of these pitch relationships. Now, thanks to The Sound of Music, young music students have a catchy tune to remember all these names for pitches in the scale, the basic building blocks, again, of almost any melody. But this system actually goes back long before that musical, and it was likely connected to a Latin hymn of the 11th century. There's a hymn that starts on what we might call the tonic note. The hymn begins with the phrase, ut quant laxis. The next phrase of the text begins a step higher, resonare fibris. Then the next phrase of the text begins a step higher than that, mira gestorum. The next phrase a step higher, famuli tuorum. The next phrase, a step higher, solve polluti. And the next phrase, labi reatum. these six initial syllables to each line, ut, re, mi, fa, so, la, are the first 6 degrees of our major scale. The last two words of the hymn are Sancte Johannes, and the abbreviation in Latin is SI. And the word C, spelled SI, began to be associated then with the only scale degree not present in that hymn, the seventh scale degree. So now we had a syllable for each scale degree of the heptatonic scale, based loosely on the first syllable of each phrase of this Latin hymn, ut, re, mi, fa, sol, la, si. Now, that sounds a little different, you might notice, than what the character Maria sings in The Sound of Music. Well, it is believed that an Italian by the name of Giovanni Battista Doni in the 1600s changed ut, the first syllable, to do. And then a couple hundred years later, a woman by the name Sarah Glover changed the last syllable, si, to t. And the reasoning was that now each scale degree began with a different letter, a different consonant. So then we had do, re, mi, fa, so, la, ti. A Hungarian author and composer came along, Zoltán Kodály. That last name is spelled K-O-D-A-L-Y. Zoltán Kodály was the one who really institutionalized the solfège system into modern music education, a system music teachers today refer to as the Kodály method. Kodály believed it was important to teach children the fundamentals of pitch through the convention of solfège. They would learn this by both learning how to sing these scale degrees and also by employing hand signs that he created for this system, a different hand sign for each syllable. And he thought this approach best develops the young child's inner musical ear. He believed it taught certain basic music reading skills through singing that prepared students to eventually learn an instrument. And solfège and this Kodály method, or elements of this method, are used today by music students of all ages, professionals even, because it builds musical skills like sight singing, ear training, how to hear and sing in harmony, and in developing musical memory. Now, there isn't time to explore all the wonderful things that the Kodály method or that solfège in general does for music education. But most simply, as relates to our discussion today, by learning these simple, seemingly arbitrary one-syllable names for each pitch, you learn the basic pitch ingredients for any musical dish. Or, as Julie Andrews sang, when you know the notes to sing, you can sing most anything. This has been Classroom Corner.
Together, when you know the notes to sing.
You're listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. Today we have been talking about the art of melody. In this episode, we have been exploring the power of a single musical line in music history. We've talked about subjects, the term for a musical theme in a fugue. We've talked about the main themes in sonata form. We've talked about theme and variations, where one theme is the only tune heard in the piece, but is varied over and over again. And as we move into the Romantic era now of music history, and we talk about how important melody was to this era, I want to show you one example of a theme and variations form that really stands out in the musical repertoire. This is a piece that is formatted more like a piano concerto. It's by Sergei Rachmaninoff, but it isn't called a piano concerto. It's called Rhapsody on a Theme of Paganini. Paganini was a famous violinist of the Romantic era, and he lived before Rachmaninoff wrote this piece, and he wrote a famous tune, several composers have taken this tune and done things with it. Here is a sample of this tune, taken right out of Rachmaninoff's Rhapsody on a Theme of Paganini. This is probably the most matter-of-fact statement of the tune as Paganini would have composed it. I imagine you can already hear how Rachmaninoff is taking that theme and doing some interesting things with it. But I want to go now to my home piano studio and show you how Rachmaninoff came up with one of the most exquisite melodies he ever wrote, and it came out of a variation from that tune of Paganini. Okay, I'm here at my piano at my home office studio. And this is the theme that Sergei Rachmaninoff uses in his Rhapsody on a Theme of Paganini. Rachmaninoff makes a whole piece, a whole piano concerto type piece off of this theme. He's doing different variations with this theme. The most famous variation, though, is the one that goes... And you think, well, how is that a variation of... And I'm going to explain to you how this works. Listen to this melody. That idea... Rachmaninoff takes that idea and turns it upside down. So instead of going... Instead of going up a third, and then down a second, and then down a second, and then up a fifth, he goes the other way. He starts high, and goes down a third, up a second, and down a fifth. Now you probably notice that doesn't sound exactly the same as the melody that we're going to end up with. Well, Rachmaninoff makes one other tweak. So instead of just taking the melody and flipping it, instead of going from this to... He also takes it from a minor key, what we often call today a sad chord or a sad key, he makes it major. So instead of doing... He makes it... Isn't that something? This melody, he takes that one motive, turns it upside down, makes it major or happy, and then he builds a whole section of this piece on this beautiful five-note melody. So let's listen now to this variation from Rhapsody on a Theme of Paganini. Stephen Huff is the pianist performing with the Dallas Symphony Orchestra. You are listening to Music for Life. Thank you. This is Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. That was Rachmaninoff's Rhapsody on a Theme of Paganini, where he takes a melody written by another composer and builds an entire piano concerto-type piece around that melody, variations on that theme. And we're talking about the art of melody today on this program. We have been discussing how melody has been treated in different eras of fine art music history. And one interesting use of melody in the Romantic era was found in the genre of opera. Within an opera, composers would use recurring melodic phrases to represent a character or maybe an idea. And the specific melody or theme used to accompany the reappearance of this person or this idea could either be found in the instrumental or vocal parts of the music. This technique was called Leitmotiv. Leitmotiv is a German word for leading theme, and it's particularly associated with the German composer Richard Wagner. In Wagner's four opera masterpiece, The Ring of the Nibelung, or what's commonly referred to as the Ring Cycle, many of the characters, places, and ideas have their own signature melody, their own melodic idea or theme or leitmotif. These recurring melodies act as reminders about each of these individual components of the opera as they reappear throughout this total 16-hour production. And this serves as a unifying device throughout a massively long work. If you were to count the number of recurring melodies within the Ring Cycle that represent one specific idea, there'd be hundreds. It's a massive work. The most famous leitmotif is the one written for the Valkyries. So whenever you hear that idea, that melodic idea, you know what characters it's referring to. The motive written for Valhalla, the castle built by Wotan, is strong and stately. The motive representing the ring is atonal and can be described as frail or mournful. Other leitmotifs include the Rhine Maiden's happy song, contrasted by the Rhine Maiden's lament. The character Siegfried has many motives associated with him. Wagner even wrote a programmatic leitmotif through a series of descending chords, creating a vivid description of falling asleep. So this was a technique that was used particularly in German opera in the late Romantic era, but this is a technique still used in stage productions and even film scores today. An original stage production we performed here on the Herbert W. Armstrong College campus, titled David, The Endless Throne Begins, has this leitmotif idea used throughout it. Here's the leitmotif for the character King Saul. Later on in the show, the prophet Nathan makes reference to Saul, long after Saul's death, and this lyric is emphasized by a short recurrence of the Saul leitmotif. Listen for it in the piano right after he says, "The hands of Saul."
God rescued from the hands of Saul. You are the man who had obtained.
So this happens repeatedly in musicals, in opera, and as I said before, even in film scores. In the epic soundtracks for the Star Wars trilogy, John Williams, the composer, uses various melodies or themes for different characters, different groupings of characters, or different thematic ideas in the movie. And this gives the viewer aural cues to reinforce that we're talking about Darth Vader or Luke Skywalker, for instance. Now here's a snippet of the theme, or I guess you could call it the leitmotif, for the character Yoda. And I'll explain why I'm playing this in a moment. But here's Yoda's theme. So that was Yoda's theme or leitmotif in the Star Wars soundtrack. Now, in an entirely different movie, E.T. the Extraterrestrial, there's a scene where E.T. sees someone pass him on the street dressed up as Yoda. Now, since John Williams wrote the soundtrack for this movie too, guess what he does? He borrows the theme or leitmotif for Yoda from his Star Wars score and inserts it into the soundtrack at that moment in E.T. So John Williams uses a theme from an entirely different movie, but one that will direct the ear to the same fictional character. Listen to this portion of the E.T. soundtrack, and you'll hear where the Yoda theme is stated, even if just so briefly. You are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. We've been talking about melody today, how themes, subjects, and tunes have been treated by composers throughout history. But how do performers apply this understanding in their treatment of compositions? How do artists apply this understanding when they're performing a piece of music? That will be the discussion in our next segment, Backstage Banter, where we interview performers on the concert circuit today for their perspectives on music. I was privileged to attend the end of a rehearsal of the Bright Music Chamber Ensemble. Bright Music is the Chamber Music Society of Oklahoma. This rehearsal was just two nights before one of their upcoming summer performances. A chamber music group is a small group of players. In this case, it was a flute, clarinet, violin, cello, and piano. And groups like this usually don't have a conductor, and they have to make certain decisions about who should be most prominent in the texture, and this is the kinds of things they figure out in rehearsals. I talked to them about that.
You know, it's very apparent most of the time who has the main theme or how the fragments passed amongst people.
That's pianist Dr. Amy Cheng, one of the two artistic directors for Bright Music.
And then you have to listen. Listen to each other.
Also, sometimes if it's not completely clear, if someone has a strong opinion on something, obviously there's a process involved in coming to a consensus, but someone has a strong feeling about something and the rest of the group is okay with it, it works. And we just usually go along with it.
That's Amy's husband, clarinetist Chad Burrow, the other artistic director for Bright Music.
Sometimes there's the perspective of sitting in the ensemble, too. You have a different feeling of who needs to be louder or softer. If you're in front of the piano and playing the cello, for example, you might feel the pianist is too loud at times.
Or that the
clarinetist may feel that, you know, that, you know, the piano is too loud, or someone may feel the clarinetist is too loud. Several of the pieces we're playing this week have flute, clarinet, violin, cello, and piano. And so mixing the articulations of the winds and the strings, coming to a consensus on that, and for, at least for me as a clarinetist, trying not to be overpowering in playing with the strings. You know, the clarinet is an omnidirectional instrument, and so the sound goes out around the instrument in a much bigger, broader sense than a string instrument. And so things like that are something to consider, too.
And Parthena, flute player, typically you're on the top melodically, but there are times when obviously you have to fit into the tapestry. How are you?
Quite a few times, really. Yeah.
Parthena Owens, flute player.
And then two, dynamically, most of the time I have to bring things up a little bit because the flute does not project, say, like clarinet, one of the other wind instruments. So I just have to kind of measure the importance of the line and where it fits and in what I play. But of course, high register is going to carry, but doesn't it, Chad?
Yes, it does. Particularly high spot.
Right. Well, and then the cello typically being on the bottom, how do you know when to come forward in the texture and when to back off?
I think a lot of it's based on experience, you know, and what's been successful.
That's cellist Dr. Meredith Blecka-Wells.
But instrument also makes a big difference. So I'm playing on a new cello. I've had it for about a week. And it's an entirely different beast compared to my previous cello. And so we were just mentioning that today. And Chad, you have a new instrument, right, as well?
Yeah.
And I think that makes for a different learning path in terms of, you know, how projection is being developed and things of that kind.
And then there are times when you have a polyphonic treatment of the texture. How do you, I mean, I imagine there's a lot of listening and discussion going on. Talk about how more than one melodic line is handled when you have that among the group.
Well, I was in part of a rehearsal of the string quartet for a newer piece that's being performed by composer Or Kribos. And there's a fugal movement, and there was just a discussion that, every time there's a restatement or a reiteration of the theme, everybody else needs to get out of the way for a couple of bars so that every time that this theme comes back, it can be heard clearly. And so that was just something as an outside listener. I was just happened to be in the rehearsal and just noticed that. So in one sense, everybody knows to do that. When you hear the melody or you hear this polyphonic line coming in and sort of differentiating between the hierarchy there. But at the same time, it's something you have to rehearse, and maybe, you know, someone in the group has to say, hey, we're covering the important line at this moment. And so it's experience mixed with really being listening constantly and also knowing exactly the kind of music you have. Is it something that's homophonic, a melody and accompaniment, or, as you mentioned, polyphonic, and really being able to hear the difference. And so you have to really be adaptable in every moment.
As a pianist, what kind of things are you listening for with everybody else?
Well, pianists have the advantage of having a score in front of us most of the time. So usually, you know, I'm looking at who is important, and try to fit in, either be the supporter or come out when I need to. I try to, anyway.
And you can see all that because of your score.
Yeah.
And so is that an advantage, would you say?
Definitely it's a total advantage, right.
The ensemble was working on music mainly from the 20th and 21st centuries for their performances in the next few days. So I asked them about the challenges that era of music presents them as an ensemble, particularly as relates to melody and bringing out the themes.
Some people listen to 20th century music and say, where's the melody, even though there is a melody, but the composers were challenging the convention, the typical convention of the tune.
Like in Ives?
Well,
the
yeah.
Tune?
Well, yeah.
What's the tune?
In certain composers, they're, you know, taking something and really giving an audience, I'll just put it gently, a challenge. And in some cases, the aesthetic that's being sought is not necessarily what we would associate with beauty at times. But that tends to be a stereotype of contemporary or 20th century music that I find generally false. I think there are a handful of composers that really were trying to do things that we would maybe associate as a dissonant or creating a lot of discord. But in fact, I think, unfortunately, that gives contemporary music a lot of a bad reputation. Most of the music we're playing is incredibly audience accessible. And I think for people that are not used to thinking of newer music as being listenable or easy to decipher, maybe they would rather hear Mozart or Beethoven, I think they would be shocked at how listenable this music is, and also not just listenable, but enjoyable. And there are certain pieces that are more challenging, but I think if taken as a whole, they give a complete or a relatively complete picture of the kinds of sounds and the diversity of music in the American 20th and 21st centuries so far.
And the challenge for you all, there's probably more of a challenge, though, in terms of finding those themes, of making those themes speak.
Yes.
Just taking the example in Child's Eyes, I mean, he uses multiple American folk tunes,
hymns, popular songs.
Popular songs, right. And he embeds it in very thick texture, disguised in lots of dissonance and colorful things we call stuff.
Right.
Just a lot of stuff. It's very important, actually, you recognize those and try to bring them out in appropriate context.
That was a portion of my interview with the Bright Music Chamber Society under the artistic direction of Chad Burrow and Amy Cheng. We were talking with them about how a chamber ensemble, or a small group of musicians without a conductor, makes choices about what part of the ensemble should be emphasized, what parts of the music should be brought to the forefront of the texture based on the themes of the piece or the melodies of the particular sections. We've been talking about melody, themes, subjects, and tunes today, the power of a single musical line or an organization of pitches derived, in simplistic terms, from seven notes that we call the scale. We saw evidence of this scale even in the biblical record. We talked about how this scale is introduced to young people through a system called solfège. You're listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. Remember that you can follow this show on Twitter at MusicForLifePCG. Finally, for dessert today, where we play an example from the popular or folk tradition to end the program, let's hear an example from more of the Broadway tradition. This is from another original stage production performed right here at Herbert W. Armstrong College in Armstrong Auditorium, a show called Jeremiah. This relates to our theme today of melody because it features two characters each singing their own melody separately and then toward the end of the number singing both of their melodies at the same time. This is somewhat common now in the musical theater genre for composers to do that. So you will hear in this case the prophet Jeremiah singing his message to the people of Judah, which is a melody unique to him, and then Hananiah's contradictory message, an entirely different melody. And then you'll hear both of them singing their melodies at the same time, what we would call polyphony, or more simply, a musical version of an argument. But yet the pitches of both melodies are in perfect harmony with each other. So this is God Speaks Through Me from Jeremiah.
Ambassadors came to plead with the king to throw off the chains that Babylon brings. God heard of their plan, he warned them through me. I made five yokes to send to their kings. I wore one myself to show to the land that Babylon rules by God's mighty hand. Oh, Judah, heed, God speaks through me. This man speaks lies. God lives with us. In 2 years' time, will our foes lick dust? The king will return for captives as well. So God tells me, now you are dead.
But you are in bonds. In time you will see which prophet is wrong. You are the one who speaks of a lie. By God's great decree, this year you will die. Oh, Judah,
You have been listening to Music for Life. From the Herbert W. Armstrong College campus, I'm Ryan Malone. Thanks for joining me.